We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday, June 25th. We are already almost through the month of June. It is just so crazy how the political year, especially in a presidential election year, just goes by so quickly. But we'll start with a lot of legal news this morning. The first headline is that Hunter Biden has requested a new trial over a procedural technicality. So according to CNN, Hunter Biden is requesting a new trial in his federal gun case, with his lawyers claiming there is a procedural issue in the timing of the early June trial that resulted in a guilty verdict against him. He faces up to 25 years in prison over the three gun charges, although as a first-time offender, it is unlikely he will receive the maximum sentence, if jail time at all. A sentencing date has not yet been set. We are still awaiting the July 11th sentencing hearing of former President Trump in the sham New York trial for the felony conviction that is sure to be brought up at this week's debate. Second headline is that Representative Anna Paulina Luna from Florida is looking to force a vote in the House to arrest Attorney General Merrick Garland after the DOJ fails to enforce a criminal contempt referral. So this is a really interesting procedural maneuver. She's planning to force a vote on directing the House Sergeant-at-Arms to arrest Attorney General Merrick Garland sometime this week. She's sending a letter around to fellow House Republicans over the weekend and yesterday, arguing that the DOJ undermined Congress by refusing to act on the contempt resolution passed by the GOP majority earlier this month. This is what's called inherent contempt. So rather than just a contempt of Congress and a referral for criminal charges to the DOJ, inherent contempt differs from the criminal contempt resolution that was passed on June 12th. That latter referred to Garland to his own department for criminal charges, and like his two attorneys general predecessors that also just skated by because their DOJs also were above the law and refused to even look at it, apparently. Inherent contempt, if passed, could force Garland to stand trial before the House of Representatives and, if found guilty, would lead to his detention by the House Sergeant-at-Arms until he decides to cooperate with the subpoena, which is turning over that audio that he is refusing to Congress of Joe Biden with his book interviewer. So very interesting there. And then let's get to the Louisiana law mandating that public schools show the Ten Commandments. So now the ACLU and other quote-unquote civil liberties groups, they're all just a bunch of leftists, filed a lawsuit yesterday to block Louisiana's new law that requires the Ten Commandments to be displayed in every public school classroom, a measure they contend is unconstitutional. And this coming from the Associated Press, the plaintiff said the law, quote, unconstitutionally pressures students into religious observance and poses an expected challenge to the only state with such a requirement. So let's bring in our good friend Mike Donnelly, who is a law professor and an attorney and one of my very dear friends for a long time, that we get to discuss all of these very interesting constitutional questions, and so get to do so with all of you nationally with our AFR family. So good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Jenna, and all the listeners. Great to be with you this morning. Hope everyone's having a great morning today. Where I am, well, it's a gorgeous day. Blue skies. I hope it's great wherever you are.
Yes, well, it is a beautiful day here in Florida. It's always a great day in the land of the free state of Florida. But we, you know, we had talked, Mike, a little bit last week about the Ten Commandments issue, but not really diving into more of the substantive constitutional questions. And I actually got a lot of questions from listeners about this over the weekend. So thought we would revisit this and kind of dive a little more into it. So first, let's start with this challenge. This was anticipated that the ACLU and some of these leftist organizations, of course, would challenge it just because it's the Ten Commandments. But saying that this unconstitutionally pressures students into religious observance because they can read, because they're observing it on the wall. I mean, this seems to be a little bit of an absurd challenge, at least in that regard.
Well, the ACLU is trying to make the claim that by placing Ten Commandment posters in classrooms at the behest of the legislature, that it's establishing religion, which, you know, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, right? That's the First Amendment, our first freedom. And there is a long history of litigation over this issue of not just posters in classrooms, but monuments over the Ten Commandments. I'm sure people listening who are of my age will remember Roy Moore. Roy Moore from Alabama fought decades over this issue and lost. He lost his seat in the Supreme Court of Alabama twice, I believe, over the issue of putting the Ten Commandment monuments and different monuments into the court in his state. And this issue, it dates back quite a ways, going back into the 70s and even late 60s when the Supreme Court issued its infamous Lemon Test, which has now been basically abandoned by the Supreme Court. So this is a very live issue. You know, it appears the court is going in the direction of a different way of evaluating whether something establishes religion. And, you know, this case is going to go to the Supreme Court almost certainly. And the court will have an opportunity to clarify, one, that Lemon actually isn't the test anymore. They've abandoned it. And two, the court's going to have to overturn a case, Stone v. Graham, which was, let me see, I think it was Kentucky. Yeah, it was Kentucky, where Kentucky actually had a law in the books, just like Louisiana, saying you have to put the Ten Commandments in the classroom. And in 1980, the court said that did violate the Establishment Clause. So this is a setup for very interesting litigation. My suspicion is that it's going to end up differently, and I think Stone v. Graham will be overturned, and the court will say what Louisiana has done does not offend the First Amendment.
And all of this is very ripe for debate and certainly litigation. And you're right to invoke all of the history. And I think it was the Kennedy versus Bremerton, the Coach Kennedy case, that was the one where the court basically overturned the Lemon Test, which had been longstanding precedent of how the court and lower courts would look at whether or not an action violates the First Amendment, and particularly with respect to an establishment of religion. And so with this other case that they're going to have to, or they would have to overturn in order to allow Louisiana to continue with this legislation and putting the Ten Commandments, what was the rationale that the Supreme Court had held to say that the Ten Commandments in schools did violate the Establishment Clause?
Well, they just applied the Lemon Test, right? So that said that, you know, a law, you know, has to have a secular purpose, and it cannot, you know, unnecessarily entangle government and religion. And in the Kentucky case, they said, well, putting, you know, requiring people to, you know, have a poster of the Ten Commandments in the classroom clearly doesn't have a secular purpose, you know, and they said you can't do that. You're right. It was Kennedy v. Bremerton, which was the praying coach case, in which the court essentially said, look, you know, we don't look at the Lemon Test on these issues. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the history and traditions of this country and see whether or not a proposed government action violates the history and traditions of the country. And putting posters up, or, you know, even allowing prayer, Bible reading in schools, there is a history and tradition of allowing that in the United States of America. And it was only in the 60s and 70s when suddenly people woke up and realized, wait a minute, the Constitution doesn't allow this. We've been doing this for 150 years. And now suddenly the Constitution says we can't. What changed? Well, nothing changed.
Nothing.
Just the judges on the court changed.
Yeah, which is a perfect example of judicial activism. And I'm talking with Mike Donnelly, who is my very special guest this morning. You can follow him on X at Donnelly Speaks. And he is a law professor and attorney. And, you know, another question that I got, which I know you will love because one of our favorite topics is the 14th Amendment, is that the First Amendment does say that Congress shall make no law. And so what does the First Amendment have to do with a state issue? And of course, that invokes the 14th Amendment. So get us there in terms of how the Supreme Court and its precedent has now applied the First Amendment to the states. And Copper is also very interested in the background in hearing about this as well.
obviously, of course, I'm smiling, Jenna, because we've had this conversation many times. And yes. Obviously, you have very astute listeners. And it really encourages me that people who are listening to you are asking this question, because most people have no idea. Most people would say, well, yeah, of course, First Amendment, separation of church and state, wall of separation, right? I mean, this is what the schools, this is what higher education, this is what the media, this is what people who want to kind of revise American history have tried to do over the last 60, 70 years, is they've tried to put a wall of separation between the people and religion. Anyway, getting to the point, so yes, First Amendment does say Congress. And so one wonders, well, how does the Supreme Court then, if it's interpreting the Constitution of the United States, have any authority over the states? Well, the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause says that no state shall deny a person of life, liberty, or freedom without due process of law, life, liberty, or freedom without due process of law, or deny a person the equal protection of laws. And so this issue hones in on that question of liberty, and what does liberty mean in the no state shall deprive a person of life, liberty, and liberty without due process of law. And, you know, when the 14th Amendment was passed in the 1860s, right, it was right after the Civil War, and it had to do with the way states, especially in the South, were treating the blacks, and they were denying them all kinds of civil rights. And so the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to prevent that and to give the federal government authority to pass laws that would protect the rights of freed slaves. And that's what Section 5 of the 14th Amendment says, that Congress shall have the authority to pass laws to make sure that the 14th Amendment is effective. So over the next 125 years, and starting in the 1920s, the Supreme Court said, oh, we get to decide what liberty means. And they said, well, if liberty means anything, surely it means at least some of the rights that the founders put into the Bill of Rights. And therefore, we've got to apply those liberties to the states. And so over the course of about 50 or 60 years, and they're still doing it, actually, the doctrine of what's called selective incorporation was underway, where the court would look at the Bill of Rights and say, oh, this freedom must apply to the states. This freedom also applies to the states. So it took a while. In fact, in 2010 was when the Supreme Court finally got around to incorporating the Second Amendment against the states, in the gun cases. So Congress now means any state. And so virtually all of the Bill of Rights freedoms apply to the states because of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the 14th Amendment and apply the, you know, First Amendment to the states. And so now the court gets to decide across the whole country what these rights mean. The states get to decide those things for themselves.
Yeah, which the states deciding for themselves is the entire point of federalism and why states should have more sovereignty and why the federal government was very limited in the inception of our founding and in the original intent of the Constitution. And so this just erodes federalism. But this type of all of these doctrines are taught as this is what the Constitution says in law school. I mean, when you go through and you learn about, you know, reverse incorporation and the corporation doctrines and all these things, in law school, lawyers are taught not to even question these doctrines, but just how to litigate within them. And that is one of the things, Mike, that you and I talk about all the time, that future litigants and especially just good citizens, like the people listening across the country right now, whether or not you're a lawyer, you know, you need to be aware of how these doctrines have come to be established as if they are part and parcel of the U.S. Constitution when they're really not. They're just a reading by, I would suggest, activist judges who are looking to undermine federalism and state sovereignty and a court that has gone well outside of its actual jurisdiction. And instead of just litigating within these constructs and these doctrines, we need to go back and question the decisions that gave rise to these doctrines originally. I mean, this is the same thing like a church that you just, you know, accept a doctrine that isn't found based on the plain reading of scripture. It's just a creation or an interpretation by man. You can go back and question that. And sometimes doctrines can be wrong when we're talking about theology, and certainly when we're talking about jurisprudence. And so in terms of, and in just the last 2 minutes that we have with you here, Mike Donnelly, and this could be, you know, a really long conversation, and believe me, Mike and I have spent those really long conversations, but I'm always glad to have you on to have these conversations. How do we start, I mean, with this case, maybe this is the start, to dial this back and to say, no, this really is a state issue. I mean, I hope that Louisiana and its House of Representatives that established and passed this legislation say, no, we can. And we don't care what your doctrine says, Supreme Court. This is according to the Constitution and the plain text. This is within our powers to determine for our state.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And I just was replaying what I said earlier, and I misquoted the 14th Amendment. How dare I do that? It's life, liberty, or property, not freedom. Liberty is freedom. I want to point folks to the 1833 Barron v. Baltimore decision. In 1833, the Supreme Court said the Bill of Rights does not apply to the states. And so the question of how it happened, you're exactly right. It's a doctrine invented by the Supreme Court. I think we're already seeing this reaction to the federal government overreach happening. You know, you saw this in Dobbs. I think there's a majority on the court who are like, you know what, we're doing too much at the federal court level. We got to push stuff back to the states. That's where it belongs. The stuff we talked about on your other show yesterday, this transgender case that the Supreme Court has taken, the Sixth Circuit Court, Jeff Sutton, chief judge there, said the same stuff in his opinion. He's like, these are for the states to decide. These are for legislators to decide. These are policy decisions. These should not be decided by federal judges.
That's great. And I'm so glad that there are some judges that are seeing this. And we hope that a majority on the Supreme Court will also see that now. But Mike Donnelly, thanks so much. And you can see the segment that he was referring to on Jenna Ellis Tonight if you go to the Salem News Channel or anywhere that you stream podcasts and just search for Jenna Ellis Tonight on the show yesterday. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Here's Dr. Ben Witherington from the American Family Studios documentary, The God Who Speaks.
I like to say a text without a context is just a pretext for whatever you want it to mean. In other words, without the historical context, you can twist that text and make it mean whatever you would like it to mean. And more importantly, Christianity is a historical religion. I would put it this way. Nothing is theologically true that's historically false. The historical foundation of the Christian faith is fundamental to our faith. So, therefore, it follows that studying the historical context of the New Testament is critical to understanding it at all.
Visit thegodwhospeaks.org.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, over the weekend, a pro-terrorism mob descended on a Jewish neighborhood in Los Angeles, and they were dressed in Islamic gear, holding Palestinian flags, and proceeded to attack the synagogue. And President Biden finally put out a statement, and Katie Pavlich of Town Hall said, notice he didn't call for punishment of the violent terrorists. Biden simply said, I'm appalled by the scenes outside of the synagogue in Los Angeles. Intimidating Jewish congregants is dangerous, unconscionable, anti-Semitic, and un-American. Americans have the right to peaceful protest, but blocking access to a house of worship and engaging in violence is never acceptable. And This coming as the Israeli victims of the October 7th terror attack are now suing the United Nations leading aid organization that for aiding Hamas in the attack. And they are alleging that the organization, quote, led a billion-dollar money laundering operation that funded Hamas and enabled the terror group to carry out last year's unprecedented strike that killed more than 1,200 people. So that lawsuit was filed yesterday in New York federal court on behalf of more than 100 Israeli victims of the October 7th attack. So joining me now to discuss all of the latest out of the Middle East and the fight for Israel is our very dear friend Joel Rosenberg, who is the editor-in-chief of All Israel News. And Joel, thanks so much for joining. It's always a privilege and a pleasure to have you. And so what is the latest update there? And are you joining us from Jerusalem or are you back in the States currently?
Oh, Jen, it's great to be with you. I'm actually in the States right now. I'm in Washington, and I'll be traveling. I have been traveling for the last 2 weeks or so, and we'll be around the country for about 2 months, speaking to evangelical groups, speaking at churches, doing media like your program, just trying to help more people understand the stakes of what's happening and understand what's happening that they're not getting through the bias of the extreme bias of the so-called mainstream media. Yeah, it's because, you know, we're 9 months into this war and many Americans don't understand, first of all, why is it still going on? Like, why isn't it over yet? And wait, you're saying there's going to be a whole nother war now in Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah? And what is happening with the Biden administration? What will be the differences between Biden and Trump? Lots of things to discuss. So where do you want to begin? Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Yeah. Well, you know, what is the projection in terms of where Israel is at with this? And now with you mentioned this possible next war. I mean, that's let's start there.
OK, so already we've taken about 20,000 missiles and rockets over the last 9 months. And most of the fighting, as you know, and we've discussed every few weeks from my vantage point base in Jerusalem with All Israel News, has been in Gaza, obviously. But the situation on Israel's northern border is getting worse and worse and worse every single day. And that's because Iran's biggest terror proxy army is known as Hezbollah. The Army of God, as it's called, and that's the that's based in Lebanon. Effectively, Iran has taken over Lebanon. Lebanon is not really a sovereign nation state anymore. It's essentially a province of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the whole country has been taken over by this terror army known as Hezbollah. So, what's happening? Well, Hezbollah is firing more and more rockets, missiles, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars at Israelis in the north, and it's escalating. I mean, you know, you'd like to think this was all about to be over, but what I'm telling people is, look, we're about to get into a much larger war that may cause people to forget that there was a war in Gaza, because what's coming, you know, but for the grace of God, what's coming is a much more intense, I would even call an apocalyptic war. Let me explain really quickly, and I'll use a few numbers. In 2006, we had what's called the Second Lebanon War. We had one in the 80s, then we had one in 2006. Now, that only lasted a month, but during that month, Hezbollah fired 4,000 missiles at Israel. Okay, so 4,000 missiles in a month. That was bad, really bad. Now, today, Hezbollah has 150,000 missiles in its arsenal, all aimed at Israel. 150,000. Okay. So that means they could fire 4,000 missiles a day for a month and still have 30,000 missiles left over. This is what Israelis fear, and this is what Israelis are having to prepare for, because every time they fire more and more, you know, sometimes it's a few dozen. A few days ago, it was 200 they fired at us. So Israel's getting ready to realize, well, we're going to have to invade southern Lebanon to take out all these missile positions and defeat all these terrorists on our border. Otherwise, we're going to have a repeat of October 7th, but in the north instead of the south. But Biden keeps telling us not to do it. He keeps telling us not to escalate. Israelis are not escalating this war. Israelis are responding to Iran's aggression. And best way to end these wars is to have the United States 100,000% with us, not slow walking resupply of ammunition to us, not slow walking resupply of missile interceptors to us, not putting us in a diplomatic, you know, headlock and telling us that we are supposed to, you know, be nice and, you know, play well in the sandbox. That's not helpful. There's genocidal terrorists on our borders, and the United States is supposed to be our ally. So why is Biden acting like we're the ones that are the difficult actors in the region? This is a serious, serious problem.
Yeah, and that is a great question. Joel Rosenberg, who's the editor-in-chief of All Israel News and joining us for another update of what is going on in the Middle East conflict. And I think the answer to that is that Biden is very concerned about the media, and he's playing into all of the leftist headlines that are essentially blaming Israel and wanting to say that Israel are the aggressors instead of rightly saying that the Palestinians are, and looking at the truth of the matter. And so you mentioned previously, Joel, about the difference between Biden and Trump. We're getting ready to head on Thursday into a debate. Do you think that Israel will be on the agenda, because this is hosted, of course, by CNN moderators, but the stance of the United States and the difference between Biden and Trump, I think, should be on full display there?
Well, I certainly hope so. And look, I know that you have had some significant disagreements with former President Trump. I've had some significant disagreements with former President Trump. However, when it comes to Israel, there's literally no question at all. If one only dealt with the Middle East and looked at President Trump's record, it's compared to President Biden, it's just not even close. President Trump always stood with Israel, always resupplied Israel with weapons, always helped Israel be strong. Trump believes in a peace through strength model, which is you arm Israel to the teeth, but then you help Israel negotiate, you know, peace treaties with its neighbors, and that combination of peace, of having strength, leads to peace. The problem is the Biden model is weakness leads to war. It's not that he intends it. he thinks that his approach is more helpful. But look at the difference. Like, Israel was not in a war with any of its neighbors during the 4 years that President Trump was in office. I mean, we had skirmishes here and there, but that's sort of normal for our neighborhood, right? We didn't have war for 4 years under Trump. We had four Arab-Israeli peace treaties known as the Abraham Accords, groundbreaking, historic. But over the last 4 years, we've had nothing but increasing war, tension, instability, because Biden sends messages of weakness. He looks personally weak, frail, and infirm. And maybe more importantly, but it's related, he does not supply his allies the weapons they need. He doesn't provide political cover at the UN like his allies need. And that's why you've seen America's enemies on the move, Russia invading Ukraine, North Korea starting to retest its long-range missiles, China threatening to accelerate a possible invasion of Taiwan. There's much more talk about that than there was during the Trump years, right? And of course, Iran has moved against Israel from every possible angle. There's a cause and effect here. Strength projected by Trump, with admittedly Trump's strength is not only policy, but it's that people, the enemies of America were scared of Trump because they thought he's a little crazy. God only knows what he might do to us if we were to cross a line. That was helpful for the America First policy. It was helpful for America's allies because people weren't sure. I mean, meaning America's enemies weren't sure what Trump might do, and it created a world of stability. That's just the opposite. Everybody knows what Biden will do. He will surrender. He surrendered to Afghanistan. He's essentially surrendering to Iran, and he's trying to force Israel to surrender to Iran. That is not going to happen, but it is inviting much more violence.
Yeah, well said. And I think you're absolutely right, Jill Rosenberg, to point out that, you know, regardless of other things that you and I could and have criticized about Trump, and I think rightly so, any Christian could find some criticism in some of his policy. When it comes to Israel, he has been totally pro-Israel and needs to take that posture not only into the debate on Thursday, but also on the campaign trail. I mean, I would love to see him talk about this more. And the correct frame for Trump is strength versus weakness. And I mean, Biden, even how he's deteriorated so much over the last 4 years. I mean, even going back and looking at the prior debates in 2020, I don't think we're going to see a replica of that just in terms of Biden. We will with Trump, and he needs to take that opportunity to really showcase how pro-Israel he is, and also and how pro-America he is as well, because this being America first means also that we are pro-Israel for a lot of not only biblical reasons, but also strategic ally reasons, and also from just a common sense war rules of engagement perspective. I mean, Israel was attacked here, and to try to manipulate this and suggest that Israel is the aggressor, as all of the leftists are trying to do, is just false. And so where is this headed in just the last about 5 minutes we have with you? Is there anything else that listeners should know in terms of how to pray for Israel? What's happening on the ground, or what's important to you, Jill Rosenberg?
Well, I think, I would encourage people to continue to pray, obviously, for the release of all the hostages. We had a dramatic, miraculous rescue. I don't think you and I have spoken since that amazing Israeli Special Forces operation to rescue four Israeli hostages that were being held in Palestinian civilian homes by an Al Jazeera reporter. I mean, it's just so insane. What's happening, but this is why Israel has to get all of our hostages back, because we're just dealing with such a bloodthirsty and cruel enemy. But the international media attacked Israel for rescuing our hostages. Why? Because several hundred Palestinians were killed. Well, who were these several hundred? They were Hamas operatives that were surrounding and guarding the hostages, our hostages, and they were the ones that came and attacked Israeli special forces while we were rescuing them. These are the only people that died. Yeah, okay, yes, admittedly, there were probably a few civilians who were caught in the crossfire. I'm not saying that there weren't, but the reason was because Hamas was holding them in a neighborhood, not, you know, they shouldn't be holding them at all. So that would be the main thing, is being praying for the release of all of our hostages, about 120 left. We don't know if all of them are alive, but we are praying Isaiah 61 that the Lord would set the captives free. So that'd be one major prayer. The second thing I would say is I'm praying a lot increasingly, especially now that I'm here in the States and thinking about it more, is who will the former president, Donald Trump, pick as his VP nominee? Right, because who that person is going to send a signal of character, values, strength, policy. Obviously, I want that person to be pro-America by being pro-Israel, right? Because I think you made a great point. Being America first means that we're strong with our allies. Whoever our allies are around the world, we want them to be strong. We want to arm them and strengthen them. Why? So we don't have to fight in Taiwan. So we don't have to fight Americans in Ukraine. We don't want to fight for Israel, but we want to provide our allies all that they need to defeat our enemies. But our allies are willing and able to do it if they have America behind us. So I'm really intrigued with this question of who the VP will be, not necessarily because that person will necessarily be the next president of the United States after a four-year era of President Trump if he wins again, but because having that key person at Trump's side provides great counsel and encouragement and strength, and I think sends an important message at a time when you know, Biden is so weak, the economy is so bad, the world situation is getting worse. But you know, obviously the left is throwing everything they can at Trump, trying to make him seem radioactive, seem you know, so disqualified to be the president. It's going to be important. Maybe this choice of VP, I think it's going to be the most important VP pick ever, though I'll add that the previous best, the most important one, was when Trump picked Pence. Now, yes. I know there's a lot of people in your audience probably don't like Vice President Pence. I still like him. He's a dear friend, and I think he did the right thing when it came to the Constitution. But the point is, in 2016, Trump picking Pence, somebody who is friendly, kind, calm, experienced, conservative, evangelical, pro-Israel, all those things helped evangelicals, some of us who were not convinced yet.
And we got to take a break there. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. This June marks 2 years since the overturn of Roe v. Wade. But did you know that the number of abortions actually increased in the following year? In 2023, the amount of abortions reached its highest level since 2012. Preborn continues to stand strong for women in crisis. Preborn is a ministry of compassion that showers women and babies with God's love, providing free ultrasounds to mothers to introduce them to the precious life growing inside of them. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and $140 helps to rescue 5 babies. Your generous tax-deductible donation will also help to provide women who choose life with assistance for up to 2 years. So please give your best gift. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, speaking of former Vice President Mike Pence, he had a very interesting and controversial take on this next topic on X last night on social media related to this headline. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has agreed to plead guilty to a felony charge related to his alleged role in one of the largest U.S. government breaches of classified material. This coming from CNN this morning as part of a deal with the Justice Department that will allow him to avoid prison time in the United States. Federal officials pursued Assange after his whistleblowing website published nearly 500,000 secret military documents relating to the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The 52-year-old Australian has spent the past 5 years in a high-security U.K. prison and nearly 7 years before that holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The new plea deal allows Assange to return to Australia as a free man, but not until he has made a court appearance in a remote U.S. territory in the Pacific. So a lot of people are hailing this as a win for freedom, that he should not even be required to plead guilty at all, even though the DOJ, it looks like, and what's being signaled through the media is that they're not pursuing additional jail time. It will just be basically time served of those months in prison. So Mike Pence, though, very controversially posted this on social media. Yesterday, Julian Assange endangered the lives of our troops at a time of war and should have been prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. The Biden administration's plea deal with Assange is a miscarriage of justice and dishonors the service and sacrifice of the men and women of our armed forces and their families. There should be no plea deals to avoid prison for anyone that endangers the security of our military or the national security of the United States. Ever, period. Well, let's welcome in our good friend Pedro Gonzalez, who is a columnist at Chronicles Magazine, and also you can follow him and subscribe to his Substack, Contra. And so, Pedro, good morning, and your thoughts overall, because this has been a significant movement since the whole WikiLeaks thing for Julian Assange to be freed. And now I find this, just the timing, really fascinating that suddenly the Biden DOJ is reaching this plea deal, potentially maybe to curry favor with the libertarians?
Yeah, Jenna, thanks so much for having me. It is a really disorienting moment because basically the Biden DOJ, the Biden administration, which is terrible and awful and vile and, you know, all those things, has just allowed a journalist to basically go home. A journalist who has been sort of a symbol for freedom of the press at its most extreme and honestly its most important. You know, like, what's the point of freedom of the press if when a journalist challenges the powers that be, you know, they wind up in jail or possibly worse? And again, this is not something that we would ever thought it to have seen from the Biden administration, but that is what happened. And you're right. The timing does seem a bit opportunistic or completely opportunistic. It could be an attempt to curry favor with libertarians. It could be an attempt to curry favor with independents, honestly, because Assange is an interesting figure. And you're right that he is sort of a libertarian icon, but, you know, he's not just a libertarian icon. There are Republicans who know of him and like him. There are independents who are not necessarily libertarians who know of him and like him. And there are Democrats who feel the same way. Because, again, Assange is he's a man, but he's also sort of a symbol for freedom of the press in a way that when we hear it from The Washington Post, The New York Times, whatever, it doesn't really mean anything. But when a guy who does his job as a journalist is then persecuted by the most powerful government in the world, the United States, you know, then it becomes something real. Assange is going to get to go home now under the Biden administration. Is an extremely strange time.
It is. And what was your response, Pedro Gonzalez, to Mike Pence's post that I read a few moments ago, saying that he should have been prosecuted to the full extent of the law? This is a miscarriage of justice. I mean, you know, my view of the whole WikiLeaks thing is that that Assange really was a journalist in the sense of, you know, he simply republished what was given to him. And we do have in this country whistleblower protection laws, you know, some of these things. I mean, we wouldn't have known about a lot of these basically war crimes unless WikiLeaks and other types of journalists are willing to push this out publicly. And that's kind of the point of the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of the press.
Right. It doesn't mean anything if we don't apply it in cases like this. That's right. Well, this is a 13 and a half year or so saga. You know, it starts in 2009 where a U.S. intelligence analyst downloaded a bunch of documents and data and handed that over to Assange to be published on WikiLeaks. This is the Manning fiasco, if you recall. And it, like you said, this is not just sort of like tattling on the U.S. government over like small things and revealing like trivial things. The stuff that got into WikiLeaks and that only Assange would ever have been willing to publish was stuff like video of a U.S. helicopter in Baghdad killing a Reuters photographer. That's the sort of stuff that the government got angry at Assange for publicizing, which the public has a right to know. Like, as hard as it is to swallow that stuff, like, no American wants to hear that a U.S. helicopter killed a photographer working for an organization like Reuters. Like, none of us want to hear that. But we need to, because we need to know what's going on over there. And that is why the U.S. government had a bone to pick with Assange. And, you know, Obama's DOJ opened the investigation around 2010 into him. And this is when Assange basically becomes a man on the run and he's seeking asylum from Ecuador at the embassy in London, and it just becomes this sort of legal back and forth. And then obviously, I think a lot of Republicans, when they associate, when they think of Assange and WikiLeaks, they think of the 2016 WikiLeaks that published Democratic emails that were hacked and leaked. And if you recall, Trump actually cited the nasty stuff in those, you know, basically showing that the Democratic Party is like corrupt and all that, which you don't need a hack and a leak to know that. But nevertheless, Trump cited those things in his debate against Hillary Clinton and told people basically to go check out WikiLeaks. He explicitly cited that publication. That, oddly enough, it was actually under the Trump administration that the DOJ actually revived the case that Obama opened and basically shelved. it was under Trump that it was revived, and basically this really aggressive persecution of Assange began under Trump, which, again, this is jarring because we think of Trump as the guy that's fighting the deep state, right? But here you have Trump's deep state literally going after a journalist. And in 2019, Ecuador revokes his asylum and invites British police into the embassy to arrest Assange. Well, why did that happen after all that time? Well, according to Assange's legal team, it was because the Trump administration told his Ecuadorian hosts that if the U.S. Basically, if you let us in to arrest Assange, then we won't pursue the death penalty against him. And, like, again, that all happened under Trump. And in 20, and, like, I'm not just saying this because I have TDS or whatever. Trump, Assange's legal team said that. A lawyer representing Assange named Edward Fitzgerald said that Julian Assange is being made an example of by the Trump administration. That's, again, that's Assange's own legal team said that. And then, oddly enough, the Biden administration, basically gives him a deal and lets him go home. So it is an upside-down world when you look at the story objectively.
And that's really interesting, Pedro Gonzalez, to go back, and I love how you chronicled that, because a lot of people do consider this first term of Biden, hopefully the last first term of Biden, being the third term of Obama. And when it was Obama that opened this investigation to Assange, and then the deep state under Trump, who, I think one of the valid criticisms of Trump is that he really did not drain the swamp, didn't understand it, didn't have control over it, and really didn't make a lot of the best decisions while he had the opportunity in the White House. They go after him even harder. So, and then now it's the Biden administration that's doing this. So let's talk about the timing specifically. I mean, with Obama, a lot of people thinking are directing a lot of this going on in the Biden administration. Is this in any way a contrast of the Biden administration trying to say, we're standing on our own, we're making our own decisions, or are we kind of reading too much into that, and this is just more a political maneuver ahead of the election?
Yeah, I think if anything, if there is, and there likely is, some ulterior motive here, of course there is, I think it would not, I would be less inclined to think it's that we need to distinguish ourselves from Barack Obama, and much more inclined to think that it's like, all right, we need to play for the independents. We need to show the independents that we're not as bad as the Republicans are saying, that, that we're not just jailing people willy-nilly, and the DOJ is still objective and merciful and all that. I think that's, if there's any political maneuvering going on, and like you said, there likely is, it's that. Because again, that is one of the main arrows that the GOP keeps launching at the Biden administration, the weaponization of justice, a two-tier justice system, that the Biden DOJ is inimically opposed to the welfare of good people. And now the Biden administration has a massive talking point going into a debate. Because remember, Trump could have pardoned Assange and was given every opportunity to do so, and he didn't. And now Biden, depending on how powerful the stimulant cocktail they give him ahead of the debate, that's something that he might be able to bring up in the debate. You had you say you're fighting the deep state, you had your chance to pardon the journalist, and you didn't. That's a pretty powerful statement that Biden could potentially use against Trump right now.
Yeah, unfortunately. And hopefully then, Trump would respond something like, well, and you waited until the last 6 months of your first administration to reach this deal. So, clearly you weren't any more eager to do that. But you're right. I mean, there were a lot of people, very vocal conservatives that were calling to free Assange for years. I mean, just during my tenure in the campaign, in the 2020 campaign, and working for Trump, I mean, I heard from a lot of those people all the time. And there was just, at least as far as I was aware, just no discussion of that. And yet you have pardons of people like Roger Stone and, you know, some of these people that are basically just Trump's friends. So it is a very interesting question. And so just in the last, you know, 2 minutes we have with you, Pedro Gonzalez, and this is just a fascinating topic, not only for journalistic integrity and the First Amendment in the United States, but then also heading into the debate. What is your projection in terms of how this debate is going to go on Thursday, you know, it, from kind of a 30,000-foot perspective?
No, I can't imagine, you know, what how this is going to play out. It's so weird. I mean, because it's hard to see, you know, how Biden is going to survive this. But at the same time, that might actually be the key here, which is that Biden doesn't have to necessarily dominate. I mean, it's hard to imagine he could. Biden basically just has to survive. He has to do the bare minimum. He has to hold on for dear life. And as long as he doesn't wander off the stage or just get completely lost in the debate,
isn't that such a low bar? Yeah, I mean, and isn't that yeah. we're going back to 2020? That was literally the bar of the first set of debates. Was as long as Biden just doesn't fall down, which he's apt to do, then he wins. And so, you know, Pedro Gonzalez, we're already out of time, but I so appreciate your commentary, and I hope that the watching world on Thursday actually expects more from a sitting U.S. president than just standing up and being reasonably coherent. But we'll see. Anyway, you can reach me and my team at jenna@afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.